Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.org.
Well, this time of year, tipping, whether you're on the giving or receiving end, is as much a part of the holidays in the city as the tree at Rockefeller Center or the menorah at Grand Army Plaza. And it's also a vivid reminder of the ubiquity of the subject of my next guest's work, the underground economy. That's the part of the economy that doesn't get counted in the official tallies because no one's reporting it on their income taxes. Many of us take part in it in some way, from artists bartering their work for dental care, nannies and house cleaners and construction workers paid in cash, to even by some people, drugs and prostitution. Tipping is just the tip of the iceberg. So in some neighborhoods, having been excluded from the mainstream economy, the underground economy is the rule, not the exception. Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh is professor of sociology at Columbia University, but he spent years tracking the shadow economy in one South Side Chicago neighborhood, and he's written a new book called Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. So we'll talk to him about Chicago, New York, and the underground economy in general. Welcome to WNYC, Professor Venkatesh.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here.
Define underground economy further for us.
Well, in the broadest way, it's just all of the ways of earning income that are not reported to the government. Some of it can be seen as criminal, as you alluded to, if it's drug trafficking or sale of stolen car parts. But a lot of it is just completely licit, allowed, but just not reported. Nannies, daycare, people making furniture, folks who will do your taxes for you, and it can be a substantial part of the larger set of transactions in the U.S.
I should mention that if your name sounds a little familiar to people who don't usually read sociology, maybe it's because Freakonomics, the book, mentioned you and your research for its chapter, Why Do Drug Dealers Still Live With Their Moms? And I guess it was that research into drug dealers that interested you in the underground economy as a whole?
Yeah, I'm sometimes referred to as that Freakonomics guy.
Yeah.
I was a classically trained sociologist. I passed out surveys to folks, and one of the first questions I asked was that I devised myself was, how does it feel to be black and poor? And then I gave them five choices, and people looked at me like I was crazy. Very bad, bad, good, very good. And I just realized, these kinds of questions are not going to help me get what I need, especially if we're talking about something that's invisible or hidden, like the underground economy. So I started doing observation in these neighborhoods.
Observation or kind of immersion lifestyle?
Yeah, living in, working with people, sometimes getting drawn into their worlds. The other one part of the underground economy we should note is, if you and I have a business exchange and it's in the legitimate economy, we can go to the police, we can go to the small claims court. The folks who sell food or who fix cars on the streets, if there's a problem, they have to police themselves. And I often became a sort of a mediator, someone who was seen as neutral or fair and that could resolve disputes.
And I gather you're going to read for us a little bit from the introduction to the book. You're talking about how in the course of your research on drug gangs, you stepped in to mediate a dispute in a street alley between a mechanic and a customer, and that changed your view of the neighborhood?
That did, and maybe I'll just read a couple sentences.
Sure.
From this paragraph.
Great.
Providing this mediation was revelatory. Quite literally, I saw a world open up in front of me that I had never before paid any mind, a world whose significance I couldn't have imagined. The innumerable economic exchanges that took place every hour, every day, no longer seemed random or happenstance. There was a vast structure in place, a set of rules that defined who traded with whom, who could work on a street corner or park bench, and what prices could be set and what revenue could be earned. There were codes in place for settling disputes and adjudicating conflicts, unwritten standards that tried to ensure that haggling did not get out of hand. The young man or woman on a commercial strip sitting outside a store no longer seemed to me an idle soul, but one who might be in the employ of that store manager chasing away drug dealers or attracting customers.
So, you know, it's interesting to me in that the idea of norms in the underground economy, because if people think that the underground economy, the black market, is something that has no rules and the so-called legitimate economy is something that does, you didn't find it to be like that.
No. And if we just think about if we put ourselves in the position of a small business person, in addition to all of the challenges that small business folks have to deal with, imagining having to chase shoplifters or police yourself or enforce contracts, folks have to create these norms. They have to create trust. They have to be able to go up to someone and trust that that person is going to give them money for a service rendered. And the interesting way in which this trust is actually located in the community is what I found is the clergy. So the clergy play a really important, because they're a moral force in many inner city communities, they actually play a really important part of mediating disputes, settling price conflicts, and general making sure that there's social order and things don't go out of hand. So it's really important for us to see that this is a moral economy, not just a goods and services that are not being reported to the government.
And the clergy would certainly not be the first group of people that most of our listeners would probably think of as involved in some way, even as a mediator, in the underground economy. And yet in your book, you list some of the main players in this social organization of the black market. The Block Association president, again, somewhat generally considered legit, alongside the gang leader, the street hustler, and the minister.
Yeah, there's a myth out there that the underground economy exists on its own, that it's a completely separate part of any neighborhood, but in this case, an inner city neighborhood. And in point of fact, it's intertwined in the larger social world.
So give me an example of that. Where does the Block Association president come in to a particular transaction, or a member of the clergy?
Sure. So in many of the communities I deal with, the Block Association president has a park in their neighborhood, and that park in the inner city is often an economic space for folks who sell food or sell clothes or fix cars. That block club president has to make sure that activity in that park doesn't jeopardize the children who play there. So they might make deals with the car mechanic or the drug dealer if they have to and say, okay, when the kids aren't there and when they're in school, fine, you can use it. But when they're coming home or when they're going to school, you can't use it. And in that way, or the clergy might play that role. Another example is a store owner who might you see a homeless person sitting in back of your store. Well, I'll pay that person $20 to sleep in my store because I can't afford to hire a security guard. And that way I'm also becoming part of the local community and preventing shoplifting and burglary. So there's a lot of these very small but I think significant ways in which there's overlap between the mainstream and the shady world.
By the way, for the record and for those who did not read Freakonomics, why do drug dealers live with their moms?
Because they can't afford to live anywhere else is the simple answer. Again, the idea that we see, you know, in movies or even in the news that people are making a lot of money, it's a very small percentage, usually the leadership that's raking in the big bucks in the drug economy. Most of the adolescents, teenagers, even people in their early 20s are making less than minimum wage. So they can't afford to live anywhere else but at home.
My guest on WNYC is Sudhir Aladi Venkatesh, professor of sociology at Columbia University. He spent years tracking the underground economy in one Southside Chicago neighborhood, and he has written a book called Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. And we open our phones for you in this conversation. Excuse me. Do you take part in the underground economy, especially the urban underground economy? Maybe you're an employer of people off the books in any way or anything else? Maybe you are an employee in that relationship. Is it an inevitable part of urban life? What's the most ingenious off-the-books transaction that you have witnessed? Do you buy goods on the street to avoid paying taxes, or because maybe you can get them cheaper and you don't worry about whether they're stolen or whatever? Call us 212-433-WNYC, 433-9696. 9692 for Professor Venkatesh, 212-433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. I guess there are certain types of transactions that people would think of normally when, you know, when the topic of the urban underground economy comes up. Are there some atypical ones, things that surprised you to see how often they took place or that they existed at all?
Yeah, one of the most surprising parts of this economy was the represented in the small business world, the African American, in my case, African American store owners, who I thought really didn't have a role to play. But because historically they have been discriminated against in terms of financial institutions, or there just aren't a lot of banks in their neighborhoods, they tend to lend to each other, whether it's $100 for a utility bill or $10,000 for expansion. You have these revolving credit associations that we often associate with immigrant economies, but in fact which are in place in African-American neighborhoods as well. There are also folks who are hiring off the books, so they're not they're generally hiring local people and paying them under the table. And they're also involved in charitable activities in their neighborhood, again, off the book. So philanthropy as a way to make themselves embedded in the neighborhood. I overlook store owners completely, thinking that it was the folks on the street corner or it was the drug dealers. And when I saw this really vast network, very close-knit community of store owners who had no access to capital or labor otherwise, it really surprised me.
So this whole idea of mixed use – economic space, a store that's got some legit business going on and some off-the-books business going on.
Yeah, I'll just give you an example of one street, just to give your listeners a sense of the variation. So on this just this one street, we have a hair salon that sells homemade lunches in the day and leases out the space for to this local street gangs for parties. We have a grocery store that's also a gypsy cab stand, a fast food restaurant where you can get your hair cut, another soul food restaurant which sells compact discs. And you know, one store called Leroy's Autos didn't have a cash register because people in the neighborhood were so poor that he just took in-kind payments. And people started paying him in appliances and cell phones, and then he opened up a little cell phone store and an appliance store next to his car repair store. The small business world is one place where you'll forever be surprised if you look carefully enough.
There's a historical context that you go into in the book as well, because African Americans had a parallel economy for many years because they were excluded from the white economy through redlining and housing covenants and all kinds of discrimination. But once official segregation and discrimination abated, the rich and middle class abandoned these neighborhoods. And that's part of the story you're trying to tell, right?
That's right. When after World War II and the Civil Rights era, a lot of the Civil Rights victories allowed African Americans to move out toward the suburbs and other areas that were outside the ghetto, thereby depleting these areas of social capital or economic capital. The demand no longer was there for many of the stores, and the stores shut down, and so an underground economy kind of came up in their midst. You know, and the government has not been inattentive to this. The Community Reinvestment Act or the Small Business Administration has often looked to the inner city to try to provide capital so that people don't have to go and use loan sharks, or to provide skills and training so that people don't have to hire off the books. But it's been very unsuccessful, whether we're talking about at the SBA or we're talking about empowerment zones, in helping the people there, generally folks come in and gentrify or do urban renewal, but the local folks have not been able to capitalize, and so they're continue to be dependent on an off-the-books world.
Sudhir Venkatesh, Columbia University professor, author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor, my guest on WNYC. And George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Good. I just want to say that I find it much easier. I actually go into the cities, buy my supplies, and then go out to businesses door-to-door. And it's a totally cash business. And at the end of the week, I do take a percentage of what I make and do give it to a local church so that it could go back into the community.
Can you be any more specific about what kinds of supplies you're buying and what your options are, black market or not?
The kind of supplies I buy are like calculators, toys, gadget items, pens, anything that a business can use. The biggest items that I normally get are toys. Clients like a lot of toys for young ones. especially around this time and the end of the season. They find it easier to buy it from me, one, because it's cheaper, and two, they don't have to go out and pay for them.
Professor Venkatesh, does this sound familiar?
It does, although I have to tell you, in the inner city, it looks a little different. So you may find, for example, the local street gang leader holding a back-to-school party for kids to buy them shoes and backpacks and things like that. One case that surprised me was that the local community came together in an act of philanthropy to devise what they called a community court, so that if folks were haggling and they had a dispute, whether it was two drug dealers or a store owner who hired a homeless person, they could bring it to the court every Saturday. And there were judges, a sort of a star chamber, that adjudicated the disputes. I mean, we can think of it as taking the law into your own hands, but, you know, we have to put this in the context of people who couldn't rely on police or felt that the police were neglectful and had nowhere else to turn. You couldn't take these disputes to the mainstream judicial system. So people tried to find other ways to creatively give back and make sure their community was stable and crime wasn't getting out of hand.
Ron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ron.
Hey, what's up, man?
What's up?
Basically, you know, in New York City, you know, everyone has three or two jobs, right? I mean, whether you do or don't, but everybody's doing something. You're hustling. I mean, I have, you know, about three or four jobs that I do. You know, which is my, you know, whether it's my own business or whether I work for somebody, you know, and things like that. You have to find a way to survive no matter what. And, you know, you're not going to rob, I'm not going to rob anybody. And, that, you know, that's not in the game. But, you know, you have to survive. And the underground economy is there. I mean, you know, I understand what this gentleman is saying, but I think it's much bigger than you think. Even all the legitimate people that are working, I think they're still hustling on the side doing this and that. Whether they, you know, they're flipping their apartments or they're subletting or doing something. Taxes are being paid somewhat, yes and yes, but people are still hustling and doing their thing.
Professor Venkatesh?
I couldn't agree more. The IRS estimates that $500 billion in income goes untaxed every year, and that's probably a conservative estimate. This is huge. And the point that I always try to make, and that's why I use small business owners, is that it's not – the underground economy is not just folks living on the edge who are doing it out of survival, but it can also include people who are embedded in the mainstream economy and that have nowhere else to turn for goods, services, labor, cash, what have you.
And Ron, for yourself, do you just find more opportunity in the underground economy?
Yeah, it's something I can see clearly. You know, I can see it wherever I go. You know, whether it's uptown, downtown, midtown, Brooklyn or Queens. You know, you could just say, "Oh, what's up? You know, I need this," and you know, you give cash for whatever you need, whatever the service is, and most likely people are, you know, like, are willing to give you what you need for cash.
Ron, thanks a lot for your call. I really appreciate it. When we continue in a minute with Professor Venkatesh, whose book is about the urban underground economy in Chicago, we'll ask him how New York compares now that he's been here for a while teaching at Columbia. Brian Lehrer at WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Columbia University sociologist Sudhir Alati Venkatesh, author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. And we're taking your phone calls on your contact as buyer, seller, employee, employer, or anything else with the underground economy around here, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. Professor Venkatesh, how does New York compare with Chicago since you've now lived in both places?
I think that New York is simply bigger in terms of the underground economy, and I think that there are a couple aspects to it that make it a little different or distinctive, let me say. The first is that as a center for immigration in the U.S., perhaps the center for immigration in the U.S., the underground economy is a key portal for immigrants who come to New York, whether it's livery and taxi cabs. A lot of it is regulated, but a lot of it is also underground. It could be nannies, daycare, and it could be very local work. again, tax preparation, custom furniture, music, entertainment, help with visas and navigation and navigating the immigration process. Excuse me. The second is that tourism in New York is much more pronounced and a bigger part of the mainstream economy than in Chicago. And as a consequence, a lot of it will have an underground component. If anyone has gone to Times Square and buys watches or handbags or buys tickets from people or takes tours, a lot of that is underground as well. And finally, there's a sex work economy in New York and the sex work industry broadly, from dancing to providing sexual services, that is enormous and that dwarfs any other city. So those are three ways in which I think New York is distinctive.
Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian, Professor. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I am one of the other side. I'm an employer, a small company. I'm highly educated. I have a master's degree. And yet I am unable to keep my company alive without bending the rules. And everyone speaks about how small businesses are killed by regulation and taxing and dollars here and dollars there, and it's no joke. So I'm forced to, in order to stay alive and keep my employees paid, to do a good portion of it cash. And it's not something that I want to do, but it's really kind of any company under 10 employees, as I see it, it's kind of an option that is our only one.
Professor Venkatesh?
The caller makes a good point. I think people can be placed in a very funny situation because, on the one hand, the underground economy can offer folks tremendous flexibility. So all those stores that I listed a few minutes ago, finding another good or service that they can exchange or they lease out or sublet their space, or, as your caller said, not paying people on the books and paying them under the table, gives them an enormous amount of flexibility. But as a whole, there are a lot of social costs to that. One is taxation, so we lose a lot of potential revenue in the government coffers. The second is worker safety.
Excuse me for butting in, but that's exactly what bothers me, is my inability to provide better, and also the liability that I have and I'm forced to put myself in. Excuse me for interrupting, but it creates sleepless nights knowing that I'm breaking the law and that I could be harshly penalized for it.
That's right, and if God forbid something happened to somebody that you were employing, casually, it's difficult to find an insurance company to take that claim. The liability issues are tremendous, and so on a whole, there's plenty of reason, plenty of incentive from a regulatory standpoint to not allow folks to flout OSHA regulations or deal off the books. But again, from a small business owner standpoint, that's an enormous advantage to doing that.
Bill, thanks for your call. And Professor, you find great resilience and ingenuity in the way order is negotiated in the underground economy in urban neighborhoods. But ultimately, I get the sense you think they do more harm than good by keeping the poor separated from the broader community, lest people get the impression that you're here to celebrate the black market.
No, that's a good point. I'm not celebrating it at all. In fact, the more, at least in Chicago and in some neighborhoods in New York, the more that the underground economy becomes a primary economy, especially in these places that can have 40% of 50% of folks outside the labor force, it promotes social alienation. These are not, the block club president who manages disputes on a street corner, it's hard for her to put that on a resume and then walk into the UN and apply for a job as a diplomat. All of these carpenters and technicians who can do work under the table, they're not building up their resume. So in the long run, it doesn't allow people to actively integrate into the social mainstream at all.
By the way, here's an email that says, on why drug dealers live with mom, the ivory tower guy missed the point. It says, drug dealers live with their moms and girlfriends, even if they do have a sizable income, because they have no job references or legitimate income that a landlord or even someone renting a room would demand to see. Think there's anything to that?
I think so, but here's another case, which is that in the inner city, a lot of landlords will allow people, because they can't get market rents, allow folks to stay in their building off the books. So they'll maybe, instead of charging $1,000 a month, $1,000 a month, it'll be $500 to somebody who might be making money in the underground economy. So the email speaks to has a point. But in the inner city, again, things are just slightly different.
You're studying the underground economy as it pertains to immigrant women here. And it is immigrants who are included from the mainstream economy these days, particularly in New York. Yes?
Yeah. Since 1999, I've been conducting a study of how do immigrant women enter the city? What are the ways in which they sustain a life here? And one of the most important ways is the underground economy. Sometimes it's nannies, sometimes it's doing daycare work. But increasingly, it's sex work. After Giuliani cleaned up the streets in many parts of the city, he sent sex work indoors, so to speak, creating really a whole new economy, one which has attracted immigrant women. The rise of online dating services, advertising on the internet, has been one of the most important ways where immigrant women come into the city and get jobs, eventually get papers, become part of their communities. We don't really have any good figures for this, but it's huge, and it attracts from Eastern European women, Dominicans, people from Central America. I mean, it's a thriving industry and one which is really difficult to regulate.
Gee, I wonder if that even gives us an insight into the hours before the Sean Bell shooting, because the undercover cops were in Club Kahlua trying to solicit prostitution indoors.
Yeah, the Sean Bell shooting really brought up a number of issues as far as the underground economy is concerned. One thing to note is that the NYPD, the police department in New York, reorganized its approach to vice in the late 1990s and, for want of a better word, sort of federalized it. So the people who were looking to eradicate prostitution often don't have the same kinds of connections in the neighborhoods that they're working that the beat cop does. And until Giuliani started these wide, these sweeping changes, the beat cop was actually the one who could go into a neighborhood and help sex workers get out of the economy and go find services, et cetera. When he put his policy in place, we had these kinds of counterintuitive effects, so that the sex workers are not on the streets anymore. They don't have a relationship with police who often help them. And so it becomes much more of an antagonistic relationship. I'm not sure that's what the mayor, the former mayor, was trying to do. But in this case, we have a situation in which the police officer in question, one of them who was in the neighborhood, really did not have a very strong connection to Jamaica. And that came out a little bit, but I think it speaks to a lot of issues about the shady economy and the way it works.
Well, I know you think that the neighborhood beat cop can play his part in these communities, but isn't that also perpetuating a system that you don't think is ultimately beneficial?
Yeah, and almost every police officer that I speak to will say, mostly off the record, that their job in poor and distressed communities is simply that it can't be to eradicate crime, but just to make sure that crime doesn't get out of hand, or the effects of crime don't spiral out of control. So a lot of police think that good police work is making sure that if there's a dispute, if there's something that could a haggle in the underground economy, it doesn't lead to a shooting. It doesn't lead to a knife fight. It doesn't lead to a physical altercation, and the parties go their respective ways. That's an approach to policing that often doesn't get talked about, analyzed in community policing initiatives, the common word for putting the beat cop in the neighborhood again. But it's an important part of how communities function. And many police officers, I think if you talk to them, would talk about that openly.
Columbia University professor Sudhir Venkatesh, my guest on WNYC. His new book, Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor. And Stephen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Stephen.
Hi. I don't know if this has been brought up before, but the ethnic, culturally ethnic component, I think, is very important. For example, the Chinese economy in China is a great deal more like the underground economy in the United States. Regulation basically doesn't exist in the United States mode, which is not necessarily a good thing, but it does make it possible for people to get work more easily, for people to start businesses more easily. I think there's a balancing point where the American economy, or the people that control the American economy, could get some huge, huge benefit, and the people in the United States also. I myself found it extremely difficult to get a job some years ago in Holland, where it took me over 2 months in New York City, at virtually the same time. Now, there's some problem there, where the identical individual can get a job in a foreign country you know, within 10 minutes. And in his own country, you know, it takes 2 months. Mm. That's just, that's the same world, same time, but, you know, same, you know.
Was one off the books?
No, it wasn't off the books. It was just a regular job.
So maybe that's a different issue. But what about a comparison there, Professor Venkatesh, with China or any other emerging economy?
You know, one thing that's often, because of the recent Nobel Prize being awarded to the founder and developer of the Grameen Bank, it's actually started a set of debate among policymakers about the underground economy.
Those micro loans to poor people in the developing world.
Exactly. Could we import that into the U.S. and develop a microfinancing scheme where we can help carpenters and day laborers or store owners to find ways not to have to work in the shady world? That's a way in which what's happening in developing countries offers us a chance to examine what's happening here. The difference is we have a lot. I personally think it's better when it's done through government here, or at least the government plays a role in microfinancing, because it's a public good and it helps to create a public spirit and address some of the other aspects of the underground economy here, like the idea of people taking launch or their own hands and not relying on the government. So that's one way in which what happens elsewhere can be useful for us to replicate a process. But we should understand that we're not in a developing country and we have a different form of government, and it should be used and promoted.
Here's an email that says, my favorite underground economy story, local bodega owner, $5 bills are for sale for $6. His buyers are crack addicts. They've cashed coins and crumpled bills, but the local crack dealers don't accept such payments. A $5 bill is the smallest piece of currency that a crack dealer will accept from a crack addict. This goes back a few years. Does that sound like it rings true?
Yeah, I have to tell you, there's a lot of perverse aspects to this process. One example I can give you is that there was a store owner named Marlon in the south side of Chicago who decided to undercut the other folks on the street, the other store owners who were dealing in the underground economy. So he tried to get all of the hair stylists and into his store. He tried to get all of the pimps and the sex workers to come and work out of his store. And there was an unwritten code in the local economy that said that, you know, it was almost like a socialist enterprise, that everyone had to have a fair share of opportunities. And all the other store owners rebelled and basically ostracized Marlon from the community, and he lost his business because he couldn't rely on their support.
Rachel in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
All
great
right.
Show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I think that for me, the internet has been in a real bridge into participating and benefiting from these networks. When my husband and I moved to Brooklyn and had to redo our house, we relied on the website Brownstoner to find skilled and actually really outstanding carpenters and painters who don't work in the sort of quote official world. And similarly, for childcare, we found childcare through Park Slope Parents, an email list. And again, I don't know how unofficial our child care situation is, but it's pretty informal, it's pretty casual, it's pretty out of pocket. And I don't know how that crossover could have happened for us before the internet.
So, Rachel, as a, I guess, middle-class consumer of underground economy goods and services, do you feel at all bad about this? Because on the one hand, you're saving money and giving people work. On the other hand, you may be pushing down the wages for people who do the same things on the books and, you know, denying society your tax dollars.
Well, I think it's a conflict, but once we knew that these service providers were really talented, we tried to refer them to other people and help them kind of grow their businesses organically. But I think it really is sort of a trade-off. I mean, I think on the other hand, in some cases, the folks that we worked with weren't really traditional service people. They maybe didn't have the same protocols or schedules or ways of dealing with people that maybe, you know, a kind of blue chip painting service would have. So I think right. there are sort of a lot of trade-offs involved.
Yeah, and another trade-off from an email, and we'll get one more thought from you, Professor Venkatesh, and leave it there. Email says, what happens in the underground economy when workers are injured on the job and don't have access to workers' comp? Ditto when they're killed, many deaths in construction business, for example.
Well, they have very little recourse. Usually they just flood into the emergency rooms. I mean, this is, in addition to worker safety, we can list other problems like environmental hazards. Somebody fixing a car and spilling oil all over and somebody slips and falls. It's a notorious problem in inner cities because of the lack of services. And so it's a constant, quite literally a constant hazard for folks who are working there.
So do you propose anything at the end of the day to improve life for any of the players in this saga, or are you just a sociologist observing life in the inner city?
I guess I'm 90% an ivory tower sociologist, but I don't think it's my job to present policy, but I try to make this stuff available and this book available to policymakers, particularly to folks who can play an intermediary role, like the Small Business Administration or a savings and loan that wants to reach out and find store owners. I think there's a lot of strategies in this book that could help them conduct a microfinancing scheme or figure out, a lot of these store owners, for example, just want $150 or $200, and a bank comes in and says, we'll offer you $20,000. And so there's a communication gap. So there's some things in here that I think can be useful to bring folks together.
Columbia sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh has written Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor, published by the Harvard University Press. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, speaking of underground economies, we will ask when you give money to people who ask for it on the street. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.